From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is political scientist Barry Posen. He's the Henry A. Kissinger Chair in Foreign Policy and International Relations at the Library of Congress John W. Kluge Center. And we are coming to you from the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Professor Posen is the author of three books, including Restraint, A New Foundation for U.S. Grand Strategy, Inadvertent Escalation, Conventional War in Nuclear Risks, and award-winning Staff Sources of Military Doctrine. Posen is currently the Ford International Professor of Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT, and Director of the MIT Security Studies Program. During his time at the Library of Congress, Posen has availed himself of the library's collections to think through the implications for the United States of a multipolar international order. According to Posen, the National Intelligence Council has predicted a diffusion of power and the emergence of a multipolar system. That is, when four or more nation states have nearly equal amounts of military, cultural, and economic power by the middle of this century. We'll ask Professor Posen if he agrees or not with these forecasts, as well as probe him on the Trump administration's foreign policy orientation, best exemplified by the phrase, America First. Barry Posen, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
And thank you for hosting us here at the Library of Congress.
Our pleasure.
Well, Professor Posen, let me first ask you about events that occurred this week with respect to Michael Flynn, who was National Security Advisor, and he recently quit after admitting that he misled Vice President Mike Pence about his contacts with a Russian envoy after the November presidential election, but before the inauguration. In your view, what does this resignation and the whole episode tell us about the administration right now and the National Security Council?
I think it's symptomatic of who we elected and his approach to running the government. He intended to shake things up. He brought in people who, though they had certain kinds of experience, were not necessarily committed to the status quo. They had a difficult time fully staffing their organizations. They had legal problems with the immigration and refugee presidential decision. So they had a lot of trouble. And General Flynn was a kind of an eccentric person by the standards of the national security business and was not really much loved. And he is a person who believes in charging ahead. And it looks like he charged ahead at a time when he really wasn't permitted by law to do so. And there was a fear that the fact that he had done that, which was known to the intelligence community, was known to the Russians, could be used as a blackmail tool against him. And it took the Trump administration about a month to sort all this out and to admit that they had a serious problem. It took leaks and public pressure and media pressure, and they were finally forced, under the worst possible circumstances, to dispense with his services. And that, of course, that means that the staff that he personally brought in will also probably go. So just as you were beginning to get some takeoff in organizing a rather unconventional National Security Council staff and national security policy, the key engineer of all that is gone, and they're going to have to start over. And that's not a good thing when you're the most powerful country in the world.
What do you make of the leaks coming from the Trump administration and the White House's overall security posture with intelligence? For example, the president continues to tweet. He has use of apparently a non-secured phone for weeks. Has anything like this ever happened before? And do you think this is potentially dangerous?
I know of nothing like this. This is our first compulsively tweeting president. And also, I think the first president who's so headstrong about his need to use these devices. It may serve the president's domestic political purposes very well, which raises questions of priority. But one has an uncomfortable feeling here that the foreign policy is in some sense being targeted for his domestic constituency. And that's going to lead you astray. He obviously has not been a kind of a foreign policy buff. So the failure to staff certain things, a failure to get advice on technicalities, all these kinds of details of any policy, they're coming after he has an impulse that he tweets. And so far, it's appeared more comical than disastrous, but one could imagine that it could produce a very dire consequence.
Listening to you prompts me to ask you about your latest book. It's the opposite of what you were saying, and the book title, of course, Restraint, A New Foundation for U.S. Grand Strategy, sort of the opposite of impulsiveness. Professor Posen, talk about the thesis in this book and your research here at the Library of Congress.
I published Restraint, I think it was 3 years ago, and I wrote the book in reaction to what I saw as kind of a systematic, kind of low-grade failure of America's post-Cold War foreign policy. And my argument is the United States has been overactive, particularly relative to the inherently strong national security position of the United States. We're a very secure country inherently. We have oceans to the left and right. We have pliant neighbors to the north and south. We have one of the largest GDPs in the world, one of the largest economies in the world. Compared to many countries, we're very well placed in terms of our own natural resources. We have a great military, great technology, this, that, and the other. We're just not very insecure. Yet, the United States has been at some kind of war twice as often in the post-Cold War world as it was during the Cold War, some kind of kinetic war. Now, how is a country without a major power adversary, with so many security attributes, and why is it at war so often? And this was partly the thing that motivated me to start asking critical questions about that national security policy and suggesting the United States actually could afford to do less. One of the great ironies here is that some of the arguments that I make in the book overlap with arguments that the president made during the campaign trail, right?
Absolutely.
Not all of them, but some of them did. So I won't say that I was a Trump supporter, but I had some sympathy with some of his observations and wondered if he was going to be able to do anything about them, right, about these observations. For example, I think pretty much everyone in the American national security establishment understands that our allies underinvest in their military capabilities. And this forces us to overinvest in ours. But there's a vicious circle. The more we overinvest, the more they underinvest because we're taking care of things, right? Now, that's robbery from the American taxpayer. The Europeans are rich. The Japanese are rich. The Japanese spend 1% of GDP on defense. On the average across Europe, it's about 1.5% of GDP. The Americans have presently at 3.3, 3.5. If the Allies did more, the Americans could do less, and we could find some of this money to invest in infrastructure and other kinds of things. Right? So that was one of the problems where the President and I had some overlap. Similarly, I think that much of the American energy, which has been military energy, expensive energy, which has cost American lives, which has cost foreign lives, in our efforts to rebuild and replace governments abroad, I think this energy has been misdirected. And I think if you look at the results, they're not very good. The president has stated on the campaign trail that he was opposed to this kind of thing. I also was opposed to this kind of thing. Now, I can state my reasons, I think, more clearly than the president states his reasons. I'm not sure what his reasons are. But nevertheless, I think he had a kind of intuitive skepticism about the last 20-some-odd years of American foreign policy. And I have a skepticism about those years. So I think the United States in general should essentially elevate them guns a little lower and concentrate on three problems, right? One is the rise of China. Doesn't mean we have to have a Cold War with China, but it does mean we have to put extra emphasis on the Pacific from a national security point of view. Second, we have to worry about a certain kind of terror. Not every terrorist. Terrorism is a tactic. It's an awful tactic. One doesn't have to approve of it. But the terrorists we're concerned about are the ones who seem to have these unusual, global, and nihilistic kinds of ambitions, like Al-Qaeda and ISIL. And then the third is the question of nuclear proliferation, particularly, in my view, the problem of the security of nuclear materials. I'm not so concerned about new countries getting nuclear weapons. The United States has a great nuclear weapons capability, and other countries should be terrified to point their nuclear weapons at us. But groups who might capture a weapon or capture materials and somehow find a way to use it in a terrorist incident would be one of the worst things that ever happened. And we should be paying consistent attention to the global problem of nuclear material security. So those are the three things I would focus on. And it's not enough to say focus on those things. You also have to think about the means you would use. So I'm very skeptical when someone says, well, we have to wage war for this, we have to wage war for that. I say, stop and think. There must be some other way besides starting a war to deal with this problem.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Barry Posen. He's a political scientist at MIT and Henry A. Kissinger Chair in Foreign Policy and International Relations at the Library of Congress John W. Kluge Center. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to a valued, loyal listener of PCUSA, Nedad Knizovic from Belgrade, Serbia. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, Professor Posen, I want to continue talking about your thoughts about U.S. grand strategy, and particularly Russia, because you write that Russia is a great power in decline, and because the West is so strong and relative to Russia likely to get stronger, that the United States is in a position to accommodate some Russian concerns. I'd like you to expand on that, particularly in light of the fact that our intelligence community has unanimously alleged that Moscow has interfered in the U.S. presidential election, actually to hurt Hillary Clinton and to help Donald Trump. Does this fact and others, for example, the fact that Moscow, to some extent, has upended the post-World War II order by invading Crimea, which was part of Ukraine, does any of this give you pause about the U.S. cooperating with Russia?
I think we can all agree that the Russians are tough customers, and Vladimir Putin conceives of his interests in ways that are not always commensurate with ours. We also know that the Russians will try all kinds of ways to get as much leverage as they can. In part, they have to use those ways because they are a pretty weak state. The Russian economy compared to ours is probably at this point a seventh or an eighth. This is a pale shadow of the Soviet Union. Russian defense budget, I would say the most generous estimate of the Russian defense budget any time in the last 5 years might put it at $125 billion. Ours is at $500+ billion. So from the point of view of Russia as a threat comparable to the Soviet Union, this is just not the case. Now, the fact is that Russia will always try and get as much elbow room as it can, and we have to decide how much elbow room we're willing to give them. Where their elbow room intrudes on our interests, we need to oppose it. Where Russian mischief intrudes on our sovereignty, our management of our internal political processes, we need to oppose it. We have many tools we could use to oppose it. And one question I think Americans should be asking is whether or not we're using those tools. We hear a lot about how the Russians can intrude in our society, how the Russians can discomfort American politicians. The United States intelligence budget, as a matter of public record, is nearly $70 billion a year. If for $70 billion a year, we can't compete with Russia in the information warfare space or the cyber space, someone should be fired. Right. So I'm not saying that we should accommodate Russia's effort to intervene in our politics. We should not only do everything we can to oppose that, the Russians should pay a price from time to time. If Vladimir Putin wants to collect gossip on our politicians, we can surely collect gossip on him, because his hands are definitely not clean. So that said, Russia is still a very potent military power. And there's one thing that Russia has aplenty is a big nuclear force. So regardless of Russian intentions, Russia has the capability to obliterate the United States, just like we have the capability to obliterate Russia. Now, given those capabilities, what the person for whom this chair is named, Henry Kissinger, what his intuitions were when he was the National Security Advisor for Richard Nixon was that we didn't have to admire or support the Soviet Union's internal system of government or the Chinese internal system of government. But we did, because of the capabilities we all had, need to find ways to get along. That was the central insight. So what I would say about Russia is we should be trying to find ways to get along. we should be trying to find ways to cooperate where we can. But that's not the same as saying we should give the store away. We also have to be realistic about what we can achieve. When Russia has sharp elbows in areas that are very close to Russia's borders, people have to ask themselves hard questions about what they're willing and able to pay to reverse those actions. It's unfortunate, and it's certainly against international law what the Russians did in Crimea. But nevertheless, I think we need to be honest. There's probably not much that we can do to reverse that. That doesn't mean we have to stand up and make a public concession, but it probably does mean that if we're trying to cooperate on things that may matter to us, for example, ISIL or nuclear arms control or other kinds of things, we may have to just hold Crimea aside. Those are the kinds of realist policies that we're talking about here.
Very good point. And I want to pick up on the ISIL thing because other analysts have said that Russia is not as good a partner in fighting Islamist extremism, groups like ISIL or other radical Islamist terrorists, as perhaps some would like to think. Now, President Trump says that we should be able to cooperate with Russia on ISIL because our interests converge. But evidence suggests that Russia is, as I said, not as helpful a partner. And we see that in Syria. They are backing Bashar al-Assad's regime, who actually, one could argue, fuels ISIL. They attack innocent civilians, hospitals, and even the moderate rebels, but sort of leave ISIL alone. So what about those pesky facts?
Look, the Russians and we had a different conception of what the risks were in Syria. And the Americans convinced themselves that, in the famous phrase, Assad must go. And there is this elaborate argument that Assad's repressive tactics did help feed radicalization in the country. One cannot say that this is not also the case. The Russians had a different view, and I happen to agree with the Russians, which is that our record in that part of the world of being able to control what happens after we knock over dictators is not a good record. So to knock over Assad without having a good idea of what we were going to replace him with would surely have turned Syria into a playground for a variety of terrorist organizations, not just ISIL, but Al-Qaeda and others we may not even know yet. So in other words, the collapse of that regime was not necessarily going to improve our position either. Now, when people say cooperate with the Russians against ISIL, I share people's skepticism there's anything specific that the Russians can do for or with us against the areas of Syria that are now controlled by ISIL. But we do have a problem that we have to sort out for ourselves and with the Russians and with Turkey and also, unfortunately, with the Syrian regime, which is the Americans are sponsoring insurgent groups, Kurdish Syrians and Arab Syrians, to try and take back territory controlled by ISIL in Syria, with Raqqa being the principal town that's under ISIL control. I never hear anyone talk about then what. Who is going to control and govern those parts of Syria to ensure that ISIL doesn't just go underground and then come back again? So if we are going to spend dollars and risk American lives, and Kurds and Syrian allies are going to risk their lives, we need to have a theory about what comes after. And given that Russia is very, very tight with Assad, the Russians, I think, need to be involved in some discussion that we should be having about what comes next. So cooperation doesn't have to mean flying fighter planes next to each other or having special operators working shoulder to shoulder. But Russia has made itself influential in Syria, right? And if we want to have some negotiated path to the future in that country, I think we and they need to have some accord of some kind.
Let's get back to your concept of a grand strategy. Going forward, how would you advise the Trump administration insofar as you do see eye to eye on some issues, insofar as that perhaps the United States is paying too high a price and we're getting limited benefits for the amounts of investment that we're making in maintaining the liberal international world order? How do you see the role of NATO, the European Union, you know, America's traditional alliances going forward? Should the United States pull back? Would that empower nefarious actors, Beijing, Moscow, or how do you see this playing out?
I think we face a basic problem, which is relative to other powers, we're just not as strong as we used to be. And that's no reflection on sort of problems in the United States. It's just about the simple fact that other countries have adopted capitalist or quasi-capitalist forms of organizing their economies. They had, in the case of China, hundreds of millions of underemployed people that they could bring into a market economy. This is going to make for economic growth in other places. And your economic power is the base for your military power. So the gap between the Americans and other great powers is shrinking. And as that gap shrinks, your ability to do all the things that you once did begins to come under pressure. And you have to make some kinds of choices. You have to set some priorities. You have to start treating the people we customarily refer to as allies, but who have actually been security dependencies, we have to start treating them as allies, which is to say expecting them to contribute more to maintaining a liberal world order, because the implies only the one that we built is the one that's acceptable. When you start having to cooperate with others, it means you have to start giving others some say in how the world works. So when I look at Europe, if there's a place where the Americans can save some money and save some capability and pass some responsibility to others, in fact, it is Europe. And it's Europe because of what I said about Russia, which is Russia just isn't that strong. For all the Europeans aside, a Franco-German combination is several times richer, has equal population, has military technology that's just as good, doesn't have as many nuclear weapons, but has nuclear weapons, spends a lot on defense, just that combination. So how can it be true that prosperous, relative to global standards, liberal democratic states living in a paradise that we and they spent decades building after the Second World War cannot step up and defend that paradise against the threat posed by Vladimir Putin, which, after all, by world standards, is just not that great of a threat? How can this be true? So my point, in case of Europe, is the Americans should be very aggressive about letting the Europeans know that the time for them to assume responsibility for their own security is here. Now, unlike Donald Trump, I love the European Union. I think the European Union is a great base from which the Europeans can build the kind of coalition, not just economic, which they already have, but military and political, that can certainly defend them against any Russian depredation.
But Professor Posen, you know as well as I do that that very European Union project is coming under great danger because we have Brexit. The far-right parties now, several elections in France, Germany, Holland coming up. So again, just to be the devil's advocate, doesn't mean that Europe is weak, but they feel sort of under siege. You have the wave of refugees and migrants flooding into the country. And you also have Russian interference in these elections. At least we are seeing signs, Russian ties.
I have a rather unconventional view of all this, that is that some of Europe's problems, in a very strange way, are of our making. And what I mean by that is we've been the helicopter parents of international politics. So when the British were voting to leave the European Union, the question of the European Union's security contribution to Britain just didn't come up. The Brits happily believed that NATO would go on forever. The U.S. British special relationship would go on forever. The U.S. security guarantee to Europe would go on forever. Who needs the EU? And this kind of anti-EU sentiments are common because people have simply stopped thinking about the problems that have been solved for them by someone else. And I think we could have done a lot of good 20 years ago by telling the Europeans, guess what? We won the Cold War. You're free. You're prosperous. The Soviet Union is no more. We should have, in the words of a friend of mine, we should have had a victory parade and then handed the keys to the Europeans and say, it's now time for you to stand up. I think we would have a very different Europe today, and not one that is in the state that it's in now. Now, I can't prove that, but in other walks of life, you know, theorists talk about moral hazard. the misbehavior that comes from having too much insurance. And we provided vast amounts of insurance, which helps, I think, allow European statesmen and politicians to engage in behavior that's somewhat reckless from their own point of view.
Let's now turn back to the United States, Professor Posen, and some other planks of President Donald Trump. He talked about America first. Now, the connotation is a bit murky because of that phrase having been used prior to World War II and the rise of Hitler and so on. But we understand that he means this as we want to bring jobs back to America, but this has an anti-trade component, anti-immigrant component. What are your views with respect to these types of positions?
Well, I'm not an economist, and some of these questions are really questions for economists. That said, many in my world, we've sort of bought the free trade argument. In other words, that in the net, free trade is welfare maximizing. In the net, it's been good. And I think, you know, most of the evidence suggests that. The trade agreements that the president complains about, the ones that we've had, yes, they've cost some American jobs, but the vast percentage of industrial jobs that have disappeared in this country have probably disappeared from automation. There's some other things in the mix that's caused it, but it's not really the trade agreements. Now, that's not to say the trade agreements are entirely innocent. I think there's a larger point here, and I don't think the president makes it in a particularly eloquent way, and I'm not sure that there's an answer to this problem that's consistent with Republican ideology. And that is, partly as a result of free trade, more as a result of the IT revolution, of automation, of other kinds of rapid changes, right? People in the United States and in Europe, people who are middle or working class people, feel themselves under a lot of pressure, particularly compared to a golden age, which everybody in every period always imagines. So the pressure is relentless to change. And in our free trade policies, in our support of globalization, in our immigration policies here and in Europe, we as the governments actually help accelerate the change. They create an infrastructure that intensifies the rate of change. Well, somewhere along the way, governments needed to ask themselves the question, those whose jobs are going to be destroyed in this process, how are we going to help them adjust? The state here, and oddly enough, even in Europe, where the state is much stronger, hasn't done a great job of helping the average person deal with the relentless pressures of the modern world. This leaves people as voters vulnerable to politicians who will press for simple explanations. In other words, your problem is a result of international trade. It's a result of those people taking your jobs. It's a result of those immigrants coming in and suppressing your wage. It's those people, those countries, the other who's at fault here. Well, the elites made a bargain with these modern forces and are happy to harvest the benefits, but they did not pay attention to the other side of that bargain, which is that there are losers in that game, and those losers need to be protected.
And Professor Posen, as we close, any thoughts with respect to the U.S. role in the world as you see it today, given that there is no more Cold War, notwithstanding our tensions with Russia? So what should the role be for the United States in the world today?
There are certain things that are in America's interests. And it just so happens that those things serve the interests of others. So I think it's in America's interest to ensure that China not grow so influential in Asia that countries in Asia feel like they've lost their sovereignty. Second, the United States needs to be able to act in the world in cases where it wants to. And therefore, the United States needs to maintain, I think, command of the sea. It just so happens that having command of the sea is good for lots of other countries. It facilitates international trade. It makes it difficult for others to invade others. Now, it does mean people have to have a lot of faith in us, and they may not like the fact that we have command of the sea, but I believe that it's in our interest to try and sustain it. So just doing a few big things that are good for America's national security do, in a handful of big ways, help others with their security problems as well as their economic security problems.
Barry Posen is the Henry A. Kissinger Chair in Foreign Policy and International Relations at the Library of Congress John W. Kluge Center. He's also a political scientist at MIT. Professor Posen, thank you very much for your wonderful insights.
It's been a great pleasure to be with you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer and producer was Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.